So Totally Business Savvy, episode 27. Hey everybody, it's Dean Soto with So Totally Business Savvy, and I hope you're having a great morning, afternoon, night, wherever you are at. And today is going to be yet again an awesome show. All shows are awesome. I think I've said that just about every introduction, but today's going to be awesome, I promise. One of the first things we're going to be talking about is just some progress on some niche sites that I have. And after that, we're going to talk about some quick selling tactics, and then I have an interview to close us off with one of the most influential people in my life, and I think you'll find him very, very influential as well. All that coming up. Hey, everybody. Once again, thank you so much for being here with me for So Totally Business Savvy. My name is Dean Soto. If you've never listened to this podcast at all before, basically what we talk about is small business stuff, based grassroots small business, starting your own service, product, or whatever it is, without any venture funding or anything really crazy like that. I mean, we could talk about that, but I've just never done that, so I don't think I have the skills to do that. But yeah, if you have any questions, please feel free to call us back on our feedback line. It's 714-643-5301. That's 714-643-5301. We have a lot to cover today. It's going to be awesome. And, so yeah, stick with it. If you haven't subscribed yet, go and subscribe at iTunes under So Totally Business Savvy, or you can just go to the website, youcanworkless.com. That's youcanworkless.com. All right. So today it is a Saturday morning for me. Yes, I am all over the place. I apologize. I have no set schedule, but that's the way it is, at least for the time being. Saturday morning, feeling groovy, feeling frisky, feeling frisky. Okay. So I've had some great progress with some of my niche sites, specifically with my receipt scanner site. And if you haven't checked out the things that have been going on with that, you can go to youcanworkless.com/niche, N-I-C-H-E. So youcanworkless.com/niche, and you can check out my profitable niche adventure. Well, you know, it's not anything super, super profitable, but it's cool. It's cool seeing that you're able to make a little bit of side money doing some good stuff. But anyway, some things that have happened with that is my receipt scanner site has been doing really well since I changed to AdSense. I also got a couple of things from Amazon and a hit or two from Commission Junction. So that equals out to a couple hundred bucks at least a month. And so that's pretty cool. At least with the AdSense stuff, that was a huge change because I wasn't getting any conversions whatsoever using Amazon affiliates. And at least because of the draw, it's a receipt scanner site. So a lot of people are going to they're probably not going to buy a receipt scanner this right after tax season is over because they're done. They don't really need it. Yeah, I get a few here and there, but before I was getting anywhere between 50 to 100 bucks just off of receipt scanners and so on alone. And so that was going well. And then all of a sudden just dropped off. Same thing with the Commission Junction stuff. But since AdSense, it's been fluctuating anywhere between 50 cents to $10. I got $10 2 days ago, and then I got 50 cents yesterday. And then the day before the $10, I got $6. And so it's just like, you know, it's all over the place. It can be kind of crazy. But if you think about it, even if you were to average out about a dollar a day, that's 30 extra bucks. So maybe if you can get it to $3 a day, that's about 90 extra bucks a month of doing really nothing. Right now, I am building backlinks. I am actually putting some work into it, so just so I can get better rankings. And I've seen some ranking increase. That's pretty cool. Not necessarily in Google. I'm stuck right now between it fluctuates depending on what's actually shown on the front page, but usually I'm between say 6th and 3rd place, depending. But on Yahoo, I ended up getting number 1 for my main keyword one day, and then it went back down to number 2. But I've been stuck on number 2 forever. But I can tell that at least the backlinks are doing something. Maybe I'm just dancing around a little bit. But I got number 1, so a pretty big increase. And I was like, oh, this is great. I love it. Ooh. But then it was down the next day. That was my $10 sale, actually. Or a $10 AdSense event, I guess you would say. But the whole point is that it's possible. I am not making a ton of money off of it. I make a little bit extra off of it, which is cool. Every little bit helps. And for the most part, before I started building backlinks to it again, I was just really doing nothing with it for about 2 months. No new blog posts, no backlinking, and I was still ranking really high for my main keyword and still making money off of that. And just that's just another option that you can have to make some passive income. I know Pat Flynn has been doing some crazy stuff over at smartpassiveincome.com, and I need to get involved there because that's it's just pretty cool seeing what he's done. But I guess he had a niche site for the past 8 months, and someone actually offered to buy it. I haven't read the post yet, but someone actually offered to buy it for 5 figures, and that's pretty cool. That's great. Especially he picked a really really good niche. He was able to get that niche up really high pretty quickly. I think it only took 2 to 3 months for it to reach number 1 on Google for his main keyword, and then there's also all of the long tail keywords involved. So he was making some good AdSense money, but he was also obviously he picked a niche where, you know, it could be bought out by different security companies and so on, and have that security company might use that to funnel people to their specific company and so on. So I think he should probably not just sell it for that much. He should sell it for a whole lot more. But yeah, very, very cool. I've started 2 other niche sites based around some household things. And one I've actually finally started getting some clicks on. Nothing too fancy, nothing too huge, but at least I know that as long as someone visits, there's a potential for some clicking to go on. So that's pretty cool. I really don't have too much in the way of visitors right now because I'm very very low on the rankings, and usually it takes months to be able to get to a position, especially because this is a pretty competitive area, and I'm hitting it hard with a lot of backlinks and using my own strategy for building those backlinks. And you can see what I do kind of on youcanworkless.com. But at least I'm getting some clicks, so that was pretty cool. All right. So if you haven't started yet, try and get some niche sites going. It's very easy to do. I actually just I just build them really quickly and use a Woo theme to get things going and move on and try and make some money. If it doesn't work, great. What you spent a couple of bucks and you move on to the next thing into the next thing. You can see when I first started out, I failed. And but at least now I'm making something and I have the experience to do more. Cool. So the next thing is talking about selling. A lot of new business people just do not like to sell, but there's one specific aspect of selling that is probably the hardest for people, and that is how to close. And what it means to close and what to do in that situation. I know that I've had problems with this for a long time, but recently things have been changing. But really, really, it's a skill that has to be developed by getting out there and doing it. Just with anything else that's ever mentioned on this podcast, you have to get out there and you have to do it and try. And I failed a couple times doing some closing tactics, but you start to learn what things work and what things don't. So I just want to give you an example. Closing doesn't always necessarily have to be, at least in my mind, doesn't always have to be about making the sale. There are several closing opportunities that actually lead you to closing the ultimate part, which is the sale. A lot of people, a lot of new business owners, a lot of people out there think that they have to close on the first meeting. And for the most part, if you close on the first meeting, you're not only doing them a I think you're doing them a disservice and you're going to do yourself a disservice, because sometimes you don't even want the client. Sometimes you don't even want to work with this specific type of person. And let me give you an example. There is a client that I just signed. Actually, my partner and I just signed. And I'm not saying that I don't want to work with them, because I'm not saying that. But it was just very, very quickly. We met once. We shot a proposal to them, and they accepted, and it was done. But just this last Friday, just yesterday, I get an email from my partner in crime, and she says that the client sent her an email saying, "Oh, I was hoping to get this site done in 2 weeks." Whoa, 2 weeks? Are you kidding me? It takes 2 to 3 months, especially for a site that is as big as theirs and as important as theirs are, because this is a really big client. And this is someone who, if we do it successfully, we could potentially make a lot of money off of referrals and just off of the prestige too that's involved in this particular client. But I'm not going to say who they are yet. But you know, they're already saying, and we haven't even started the project. The client said, "I was hoping to get something in 2 weeks. Would there be something that we could do right now, to get something up and running?" And I'm thinking, oh man, this is not a good sign. We haven't even designed anything yet. We haven't even talked about anything yet. We haven't met with them as far as the design portion of it yet, and they're already asking if it can be done in 2 weeks, even though the proposal says 3 months. That is amazingly huge. So anyway, it's not necessarily a bad sign, but when you go too fast in the sales process, because the sales process is not just about you, the sales process is also about, it's not just about getting a sale, it's also about seeing if you want to work with this particular client. And there's been clients that I have not wanted to work with. In fact, if you listen to the last episode, I ended up basically saying, "Nah, I don't want to work with you." She asked if I could. Finally, she ended up asking if I could do her website, and I said, "You know what? I don't think we communicate well. And here's a referral to some people that I know. And there you go." So it's not just about closing a deal and getting money. It's about finding if you want to work with that particular client too. And that's huge. That is so important. And a lot of people forget about that. It is super important, super important. But how do you close? What are the steps in selling and what are steps in closing? Let me give you an example of a close that I just did that has not led to a sale. Selling in general is like dating. It's a series of steps. If you're closing on the first date, then something's wrong. Either you're doing something wrong, or the other person is doing something wrong, or the other person is you're not going to meet their expectations. you're not going to meet their expectations. You wouldn't get married on the first date. You wouldn't get, I mean, most people in their right mind wouldn't. But, you know, there it is a huge marriage when you are actually, when you actually sign the documents and get started on work or delivering a product. That is a marriage that is going to last a long time. Yeah, the project might go 3 months, but you're going to be with them if you're good at what you do. You're going to be with them for a lifetime because they're going to be your referral engine. They're going to be your referral machine that's going to constantly give you referrals and so on. Or they're going to be the ones who tell how awful you are, how just completely horrible you are. So to close immediately is just not the right thing to do. All right. So that being said, what is closing? Closing is basically just getting to the next step and guiding your prospect to that next step. At least in my mind, I'm sure other people have other definitions, but that is what closing is about. So for example, I got a lead for a vet the other day, a veterinarian that wanted a website done for a specific niche, which was actually a really cool niche. I got them on the phone. Finally, I actually called and I was put on hold forever. And so I hung up the phone, sent an email off and said, "Hey, Dr. So-and-so, and I probably wouldn't recommend doing this because it depends on the person, but I said, "Hey, I gave you a call. I was on hold for a long time. No worries. Happy Friday. Is there a better time and number to reach you?" And almost immediately he wrote back and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I was on the other line with a client, with a patient or with a, doggy or whatever. Call me back. It's urgent." And so, ended up calling back, got on the phone and he was in the middle of an examination and said, "Okay, well, I'm in the middle of examination, but let me give you a brief overview of what I'm looking for." And the brief overview took like 15 minutes. I'm like, you're doing an examination. why are you taking so long? But that just goes. I just listened. And if you listen to some of the older podcasts that talk about how listening really separates you from other salespeople, I listened. I basically just listened for 15 minutes on the phone. And he eventually closed himself. There are what are called closing signals or buying signals, and he said, "Okay, so what's the next step?" Or he said either "What was the next step?" or "What should we do next?" And I said, "Well, we should let's definitely meet, and we'll talk about this and that and this and that." What I essentially did was, when he said that, I knew that he wanted to go to the next level. He liked me because I was listening. He obviously felt that I had whatever it is that he needed. And so his buy-in signal, it was almost like someone who you're trying to ask out on a date, or if to trying to feel if they want to go out on a date, and they say, "So what are you doing next week?" That's basically the same exact thing. He says, "So what do we do? What's the next step?" And I, without hesitation, see that as a buying signal. I try and lock down a meeting with him to meet him in person. This way, when you meet them in person, I can, partner and I can draw things out. We can have him take the pencil, draw things out of what he would want to do, kind of take ownership of things. We could have, you can even have a proposal drafted up if we wanted to at that time. Usually I don't, but we could. Typically that's what I would meet and then do a proposal, meet again and have him sign it. What it does is it solidifies the relationship. That was a close to get to the next level of meeting in person, taking a time, especially if it's a doctor, veterinarian, very busy. And so to meet in person, it's a pretty big thing. He's not going to do that with a lot of people. So it ends up being about a 90% chance that he's going to buy from us unless we do something to really, really screw that relationship up. So the next time when we meet, what I'm going to do, like I said, is I'm going to have him take ownership. I'm going to listen again. We're going to ask his, what he needs and so on. Have him draw it out. Have him draw things on a piece of paper and see what exactly he needs and have him feel like he owns this. This is his idea and so on. And then we'll come back with a proposal. Well, at the end of the meeting, we'll say something like, okay, well, what we do like to do at this point, since it looks like we're going to be doing business, something like that to lock in the fact that we're going to be doing business, because you never want to do a proposal without really having that assurance. Say, well, it looks like we're going to, you don't have to say it like a salesman, but say, you know, it looks like we're able to do what you need and have the same goal and the same mindset that you do when it comes to this type of thing. We're very happy and we're pretty excited to do business together. What we'll do and what that did was basically solidify to 95% that this person's going to go with us. And then from there, what we'll do is we'll send you a proposal within the next 2 days. How about we meet on Thursday of next week or something like that? How about we meet on Tuesday of next week, go over the proposal, answer any questions that you have, and then we'll sign and move forward. Doing that, it gives them a roadmap. It gives them a way of just knowing, okay, this is what I need to do. They're going to answer all my questions. And once all my questions are done, I'm closed. I'm going to go with them. Basically, we close it at that point, because is he really going to say no if we get a proposal and he agrees to a meeting? It's very, very, very unlikely that he is going to say no, that he is going to say no to us the day that we meet to talk about the proposal. He might have questions, but rarely is he going to say no, I don't want to do business with you. I wasted hours on you guys. You guys do have what I need, and it looks like it's going to be awesome, but I'm not going to do it. That's very rare, especially in person, especially face-to-face. That doesn't happen too often. So you take these little closes. The closers are where you tell them what you want or what you need them to do to have this relationship move forward. They ask, and you just turn around. So some buying signals, some closing signals are, well, what's the next step? Or something like, okay, what do we do next? Oh, okay. Or, oh, I'm excited to get this project started. Or, wow, this is exciting. Things like that. As soon as someone says, wow, this is exciting, and I would just immediately, without hesitation, say something like, oh, I'm excited too. This is great. Well, let's, what we'll do is, we'll shoot you a proposal and we'll meet this day or whatever. You just go along and you say, yes, I am excited too. Let's do this. And it guides them and shows them that you have things under control. And it gives them the opportunity to buy from you. Very, very powerful. Takes a lot of listening. Takes a lot of patience, because a lot of people want to just sell on the first date. They just want to do it, just get the thing done and signed. But it's always a bad thing. But it's super, super, super easy once you start seeing and once you start feeling out customers. Some people don't give you a buying signal. Some people don't like you. There was a finance guy that I was sitting down with who hated me. I can tell that he didn't trust me. He didn't like me. And so, you know, I couldn't really do anything in that situation. So you move on to the next one. And that's a good thing, because you don't want to be in a relationship with someone who doesn't like you or doesn't seem like they are going to be a good customer, right? That's right. All right. Well, let's move on to the best part of this episode. The best part of this episode is going to be an interview with someone very special to me, someone very near and dear to my heart. And he has to be because he is my father-in-law. But he has some really great wisdom to share with you all about just business in general. He owned a contracting business long ago, but he still does contracting on the side. And just he has been instrumental in the success of what I've been doing on the side. And so I hope you get a lot of out of it. So here is my interview with my father-in-law, and hope you guys like it. All right, everyone, I have a very special guest with me, and this man is near and dear to my heart. In fact, he has to be. He's my father-in-law, but he is also a very business-savvy man, more business-savvy than I am, and has been doing some pretty cool things in the world of contracting. Not government contracting, but contracting in a sense of building things, which I have absolutely no talent in whatsoever. But so here's my father-in-law, Chuck. And so, Chuck, if you can, introduce yourself to everyone, what you do now, and what you did for your business.
Thanks, Dean. You're way too generous with your intro and your compliments. I am currently a teacher of in the middle school public education system, teaching special education kids how to read and how to write. That was my first love when I graduated from college, was teaching. I went into teaching at that point and taught for about 8 years. At the same time, I also had a desire to be able to use my hands and do some more, let's say, practical, applicable work. And so I volunteered my time and my services to my father-in-law at the time, who was in construction, just for the sole purpose of learning how to be more manual, let's say. So my initial experience with teaching was exciting. It was my first job out of college, and it was really what I wanted to do. I felt very fulfilled in what I was doing. And right out of college, I couldn't spend all of that $9,900 a year that I was earning. But I soon found, as I got married and wanted to start a family and buy a home, that that type of income wasn't going to allow me to achieve the goals that I had in mind for myself. So, So I started to work a second job, as many teachers in the 70s and 80s did, because at that time, teaching was a profession practiced by those who were just in love with the profession, and money was kind of expected to be a secondary issue. So most teachers had a second source of income. Summers obviously availed themselves to that opportunity to earn money. So wallpapering, selling real estate, working at Disneyland, just different ways. So my way was to work with my father-in-law, and then as I became more proficient and independent, I began to do work on my own. So it was during that same time that I began to experience that sense of working for yourself, being answerable only to yourself. And there was something very appealing about that to me, going out and procuring your own jobs and seeing them through to their end. And that I found that very enticing and very exciting. Mm-hmm. So as I progressed into my teaching career, I increased the amount of time and effort that I was putting into my second job. And then I kind of reached a tipping point where my second job was earning me as much, if not more, income than my primary job. So at that point, I was faced with a real tough decision. Do I give up the profession that 5 years of college had prepared me for, or do I kind of answer that call for, you know, for that, I think it was the entrepreneurial spirit that was kind of ringing in my head, and as well as the desire to, you know, to earn more money and to be able to provide, you know, more for my family. So I was fortunate that I was able to take a leave of absence. Oh. So I had I was able to keep the security of the job. So I took a leave of absence and then pursued the contracting full time. And after 4 years of that, and knowing that I could always fall back to teaching if that was unsuccessful, I kind of gave it my full effort. And after 4 years, it seemed to be going well. And so at that point, I decided to leave teaching what I thought would be permanently and then pursue the contracting business full time.
Wow. So you said it kind of came, well, that was actually pretty fortunate to have such a long leave of absence available to be able to kind of have that safety net, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it was the timing. The district I was teaching in was experiencing declining enrollment, so they were actually laying off teachers. So they were happy to actually grant me that leave because that was one less teacher that they would have to lay off.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of just a fortunate circumstance that allowed me to, you know, to pursue that direction.
That's awesome. So now, was it hard moving from, because especially with your teaching job, it's very regimental. You had to be there at a certain time every day. You had your vacations and so on in somewhat of a schedule. Was it hard creating your own schedule? And especially with things like lead generation, how did you go about kind of systematically, you know, find ways to find customers and so on?
Well, that's always the driving force behind every business, is procuring leads that will lead to the income generation that you need to do. First, let me answer your question. The excitement of working for myself and realizing that only through my own efforts was I going to earn any money, you know, that was the combination of those two factors definitely kept me, you know, on the goal-oriented path towards, moving forward. So, the day didn't have any limits. As in teaching, you know, you would start and finish at a certain time. But, when you're working for yourself, the day is as long as you choose to make it. And that was really not a negative thing. That was really a positive thing, because that was just more hours and more opportunities. So I was, I was excited. I was young. I had the energy to pursue that. But the reality of procuring business and new business, you know, faced me real quickly, because the type of contracting I was engaged in is basically home improvement, backyard type things, and those projects would last maybe a week, and then you'd be on to the next one, and oftentimes it wouldn't even be that long. So you always, you were always faced with where's the next job. So, you know, I just looked around me at what other people were doing in the industry that I was in. I would either talk to people, or I just would be aware of the types of things that they were doing. And I just used my own evaluation of what I thought would be effective. And as it turned out, it was very much a trial and error thing. I always thought that my ideas were always brilliant and innovative, but I soon found out that, for every good idea you have, one of your ideas probably doesn't meet your expectations. So, it was a lot of trial and error, and hopefully some, educated decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But it moved forward. They were good times that I entered into, good economic times. So I was able to start small with a local, throwaway flyer through the mail that was relatively inexpensive. I could control the number of publications that went out to what area, and and so I started small and then kind of went from there.
Wow, that's great. Whoa. Was there something in particular, kind of a technique or strategy that really, really paid off? I know you did trade shows and yes. things like that. Mm-hmm. Were those the most effective in reaching out, or what was?
Yeah, I think it was the presenting my, creating an opportunity to present myself and to sell myself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we went into what would they call home and garden shows that were put on by, you know, private promoters, but they were put on in large convention centers, and they would promote them, and they would bring in a large number of people. So I was able to show my product. I was able to show my workmanship because we would build displays. Mm-hmm. And I was able to sell myself and my company because I would work it oftentimes where I would be meeting the public. My wife would work it. My daughters would work it. You know, we prided ourselves. We sold ourselves on being a family-run operation. And we had great success with that concept. I would then follow up by going out on the estimates, meeting the people, giving them the estimates, and then, when possible, I even follow up by being on the job site. So, so I found that to be the most effective is when I could distinguish myself from everybody else. That's the key. There were a ton of contractors in a similar industry, and to the uneducated consumer, they all look the same. You have to try to set yourself apart from everybody else in some way so that they will remember you, that they will kind of set you aside from the pack. And so that was my way of trying to do that.
Oh, that's a very hard thing to do. At least in my business, what I'm doing right now, that is one thing that I want to do so badly, and it just comes, I guess it comes gradually, but that is so tough to do, is to set yourself apart. But you're absolutely totally right about that.
Even not only would I try to sell myself, but then I would even try to find a way to offer some type of a variation on the standard product. Mm-hmm. Something that I would do that was a little bit different than everyone else would do, with, you know, with a patio cover or with a patio room or with, you know, some backyard project. How am I going to offer it to them a little bit different? Because, you know, you also want to make sure that, or you try to want to make sure that people can't, I mean, it's a little bit, I don't know, I wouldn't call it deceptive, but you're trying to not allow the customer or the consumer to compare apples with apples.
Yeah.
You want to make yourself a little bit different so that if they are comparing you to someone else, that the consumer wants to do that. The consumer wants to say, just show me A so I can compare product A with another person, mm-hmm. and whoever then gives me the best price or the best service or something,
then I'll choose there.
Yeah, but I found that if you could offer something that was, you know, a little bit unique, a little bit special, that kind of would give you an edge sometimes also.
Oh, wow. That is really awesome. Yeah, the kind of getting yourself to not be a commodity, mm-hmm. that is something that, yeah, it's a... It's definitely gives you such a huge advantage in the same, especially in your specific arena where it's super saturated with right. competition and so
right.
on.
Yep.
Wow. So you had mentioned that you were family run and that you would try to be on the job site. So I assume that you had some workers with you as well. Mm-hmm. How did you go about hiring them, and what were some of the pitfalls and some of the good aspects of having your own employees and so on?
I always tried to look, I think I looked first to, even in that, I looked to family. I looked to opportunities to hire people that I knew within my family to, you know, to work together. I used to think that there was some loyalty in working for family, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't work. Beyond that, I would look within the industry for salespeople. Like, let's say I wanted to hire salespeople, I would look to people that were already in the industry, that already were familiar with the product. I had mixed success with that. I found that some of them turned out to be effective, but I also found that in hindsight, they brought with them previous training and previous orientations, And in some cases, I wish I had been able to kind of mold them from the beginning, and in terms of my philosophy and my way of approaching business. And and that was a trial and error thing also. Employees, there's no exact science on hiring an employee and finding someone that's going to be motivated and self-driven and have your same and your interests at heart. Some do, and some certainly don't. And I had success, and I definitely had some people that were less than successful.
Yeah. Did you ever, any employees where you thought they were doing well, but when you actually went and inspected their work, or even months down the road, some problems?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's, I always, of course, being the owner, I always had the highest level of expectation, and not many people met that level, but there was an acceptable level. But that's kind of the reason that I tried to stay as involved as I could in as many aspects as I could, which actually ultimately, in hindsight, probably wasn't the wisest thing to do. I really spread myself too thin because I felt like I was the only one who could do things to the level that I wanted them done. But I found that, yes, there are quality people out there, and no, I don't need to have my hand in every aspect of the business. Delegation was definitely something that took me a long time to learn. And I wish I had learned it sooner, but those are the things that you learn as you go when you enter into a new endeavor.
That's a tough one. I just recently, I was looking over some of the articles, because I do article marketing for my niche sites, and you know about my niche sites, we were just talking about them recently, and I was looking over some of the articles that my past employees or past virtual assistants did, and I didn't have the time to check everything, but I was going to reuse some of them, and I started reading them, and I'm like, oh, man, these really suck, and there's no way I could put this out there, and that's too bad that I basically kind of wasted some of my money on some folks that weren't as good as I expected. But at the same time, I have employees that really rock it for me. So it's very hard, and that's probably one of the hardest aspects.
And over time, you almost have to factor that failure factor, into your plan, into your financial plan, that you are going to, some of your lessons are going to be costly, and that's just part of the cost of doing business. I know one thing I found, that when I did find a good employee, and when I would train that employee, and then he began to be very efficient and make money for me, that I found that a typical pattern and trend was, as well as I tried to teach them and as highly as I tried to compensate them, that the very, very good employees oftentimes are looking to move out, to move onward and upward. So you just, you try to maximize the opportunities when you have them, but in reality, a lot of the very, very good ones are going to look to different horizons.
Which is good, but like you said, you just have to factor that in and take advantage, and hopefully later on it will benefit you in some way as well.
Yeah, the whole training process is that when you're training someone, you're not making, you're not necessarily making money on them at all. You're investing, and then you reach a fulcrum point where now they start making money for you, and the investment that you made starts paying off to you in terms of them being, productive in a profitable way.
Yeah. Ugh, it's amazing. Amazing. So, a lot of the people who listen to this either have just started a business or they are looking to start something. And so what do you think is the most important part of actually doing and starting your own business, and maybe some pitfalls?
I think my security bias towards safe, being able to survive, being able to provide for the people that you need to provide for, had a great deal of influence in terms of my philosophy. I don't think I was a huge risk taker. I tried to do what I felt comfortable and familiar with. Tried to gauge what I thought would be a reasonable expectation, that there's going to be a return on this action, and that would be the action I would take. you can afford to be more risky, I believe, further up the line. I think when you're just starting, I think you want to try your best to assure that you're going to succeed, even if it's at a modest level, and then grow. And then I think some of the bigger risk taking can take place, you know, when you're more firmly established and you can actually afford, you know, if the risk doesn't pan out, okay, you can absorb that. But if I got too risky too early, I ran the risk of losing everything.
Yeah. And you actually taught that kind of to me because you get to hear it all the time of me complaining and whining and, and you know, a lot of the books that they have right now out there is just say, hey, go follow your passion, get out there, you know, drop everything and you're going to do fine. Don't worry about it.
I think we get terribly influenced by the very rare success stories, the instant millionaires who found some particular product or niche that caught on. But those are, if on a percentage basis, those are so minuscule and so small. And for every one of those high success stories, I would guess that there are many, many people that took, you know, unnecessary risks and weren't successful. But it's, you know, they're nice to keep us motivated, but I think we have to look at those in perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And those constraints, constraining yourself and being disciplined like that, it helps you to grow and be more creative by not taking those huge risks. Mm-hmm. How can I develop a business right now with the resources that I have, with the whatever technology I can use or whatever? Because had it been my way, I probably would have jumped ship and totally just sank. But now I'm able to, you know, I have my business and I'm able to have my full-time job, but also not kill myself working because of all the creative technology uses and my awesome virtual assistants and so on. And so, yeah, that's all that is in part to this wise man.
I think any venture in life, whether it be business or personal or whatever, has a learning curve. And I think we have to give ourselves the time to experience those things that you can only experience when you're in the midst of them. You may think you know everything there is to know about a venture, but until you actually dive in, you'll never know the things that are there to face you. And so, you know, give yourself time to experience those things. So, you know, maybe set your expectations and your goals at a modest, but, you know, but ambitious, but modest level, so that you can achieve success, even if it's modest success. That's a heck of a lot better, you know, than trying to deal with failure upon failure, especially at the beginning. You need to build your confidence and while you're learning. So I think if you can combine building up your confidence and learning this new venture, that you're definitely on the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I actually stole him from, he's fixing something in my house because God knows I can't and won't and refuse, because these hands are so delicate. And I'm just not, that's just not who I am. Well, but hey, if he needs his computer fixed, who's the first person he talks to?
That's it. That's it.
That's right.
It's a very fair trade. And so
computers, VCRs, Blu-ray players, whatever. Mm-hmm. But thank you so much for coming on the show, Dad. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dean.
All righty. All right. I hope you loved that interview, because that was awesome. If you can't tell, he is very knowledgeable in business, very knowledgeable in being able to not only run your own business, but to sell and to market and so on. Very, very good bits of advice. So I hope you all got something out of it. If you have any questions for my father-in-law, I would love to have him on again. So if you have any questions, you can either email me, you can send me a WAV file or an MP3. using your iPhone or whatever. You just record into your little audio note-taking application and shoot an email to me with that. Or you can just call on my feedback line. It's 714-643-5301. That's 714-643-5301. And yeah, you can ask him a question. You can ask me a question. You can send some comments, some things, maybe something to clarify and so on. All whatever it is, just definitely, we would love to hear from you. That's 714-643-5301. And, or you can email me at dean@prosulum.com. All right, so that is the end of this episode of So Totally Business Savvy, and hope you guys liked it. Hope you guys got a lot out of it. Everything is starting to ramp up. So much stuff is going on, and I want to share everything that I learned with you guys. So if anything was not clear, if anything was not let's just say clear. I don't know how to say it in a very knowledgeable way. Anyway, if anything needed some clarification, that's what we should say. Just let me know. 714-643-5301, and I will make that clear. So I've been doing a lot of cool stuff with my ebook lately. So if you don't have my ebook on virtual assistants and use it and how to use virtual assistants to really make a killer business where you do not have to constantly be working in the business, but you can work on the business, then you definitely need to check it out. I'm hiring another virtual assistant to help me and my virtual assistant to do some web development, because things are going so fast, and without doing that, there would be a lot of problems. All that being said, I think that now is the time to definitely check out my ebook if you haven't. It's 31 Days to Building a Killer Business with Virtual Assistants. Not only do you get the ebook, but you also get about a 2-hour-long webinar session, and you also get some business models as well. And that's basically going to be my flagship product. If you have any interest whatsoever in having a virtual assistant and how to use them in a business, then you need to get it. Seriously. It's not like Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week or other virtual assistant stuff out there. You know, this is stuff that I'm doing right now with my business that I'm trying to share with you. And as I learn new things, I will be updating. So it will be constantly updated for life, pretty much. All right, so I hope you guys have a great rest of your week, and a great rest of your month, and a great rest of your year, and I will see you again. See ya.